Hey friends, Devin again for the Bardic Babble podcast, the show where we talk to creators about the things that they create. On today's episode, we have one of the key figures who has popped up on several other episodes of this show, Spencer Stark. Spencer has worked with Ivan Van Norman, Doug and John, and of course, over on Perilous with Jordan. So it just felt right to get him on for an interview. We dive into Alice's Missing, Icarus, and just what it means to create games for Spencer. But before we dive into the episode, I have a couple of quick announcements. First off, it's the easiest one, we now have a TikTok. If you're over on TikTok and you enjoy micro content, DM tips, and a little bit of D&D comedy, head on over. We are at Bard Podcast, all one word. And the second announcement is a little less exciting, but it's the right time. I always envision this show as short-form seasons, so we're going to look to wrap it up. We'll do one more episode to just get some final thoughts and feelings, have a special surprise guest of mine on the show to just kind of process this entire season and our tabletop RPG dive. I know there are thousands of amazing artists, layout designers, and content creators in the tabletop RPG space. And I would love to interview all of them, but I think it's time to move on to season two and start looking at what that is. If you're looking for more tabletop RPG specific shows, might I suggest Roll for Persuasion or The Ironbound Chest? Roll for Persuasion interviews D&D and D&D adjacent content creators, designers, actors, and actresses, and is amazing. I truly enjoyed their show. It's what actually inspired me to do mine. And then, of course, there's the Ironbound Chest. They introduce smaller content creators doing some very amazing and unique things that really inspire you and your table. So as we start looking to a season two, I'm not exactly sure what we're going to cover, but if you follow us on social media, I'll be sure to talk about it over there. We are on Twitter, we're on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. We try to post on there as frequently as possible to keep everybody up to date. For those that have taken this journey with me, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate your comments, your feedback, your questions, and even some of your suggestions for guests on the show. I greatly appreciate it, and this has been an amazing journey in tabletop RPG, and I can't wait to see what comes next. And without further ado, our final episode of the Tabletop RPG Run, the Bardic Babble Podcast, Spencer Stark. All right, welcome back, listeners. Joining me today is one of the more brilliant and well-connected game designers in the entire tabletop RPG space. Today I'm joined by Spencer Stark. I'm so glad we were able to finally get you on, Spencer. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you so much for such a kind introduction. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. So over the last few weeks, we've been really just kind of picking at tabletop RPGs and then kind of segueing over into board games and just the very fine line between the two that we're finding in 2020.
Sure.
And your name has come up on several projects. You know, Ivan Van Norman was talking with us about Alice Missing.
Yeah.
And then John and Doug chatted with us about Kids on Brooms. And of course, your name is on both of those. So I'm glad we were able to get you on, because I want to know what goes on in that head of yours, how you come up with these ideas. I mean, Icarus is bar none one of the coolest board games that I have ever had the opportunity to check out. So how did you get your start? Like, how did you get into game design?
Yeah, so I started I started in the film industry. Like, I went to film school, and I was doing that whole track, and that's what I kind of wanted to do with my life and what I was focused on, and that's still where I work. I'm a producer in LA. But as I was like pitching projects and trying to get stuff off the ground, I was finding that I wanted to tell stories that were basically finding their way into the desk drawers of executives and never seeing the light of day, because they were too big, they were too grand, they were too, you know, they're sci-fi and fantasy and these kinds of things. And those are very expensive to make. And so I was never getting the opportunity to make those things because they were too expensive. So I started exploring like board games and those kinds of things because I loved playing in those kinds of spaces, and those gave me the opportunity to do that. And I was on a show. I was on a trivia show, producing a trivia show for a company, and it was a show where we had people in an elevator, and they were moving up the elevator. Every question they answered right, they would like go up the elevator, and I had to go up a floor. And if they got the top floor, it was, you know, very like cash cab kind of like show.
Right.
And we had this pair of twins that were playing, and they were D&D players. That was like what they loved to do. And I had never played before, and they were talking about it, and they were like, oh yeah, we like make up stories and like play in fantasy worlds, and you like have a character and you like run through adventures. And I was like, why have I never done this? This is like what I love. Why have I never? And so they came out of the elevator after the show, and I ran up to them and we're like, can we play D&D together? They were like, sure. And that is how I started playing RPG. And that was only a couple of years ago. And so we played that, and I soon found like the indie RPG space. And from there, I started to explore like what it means to make games, right? And like what it means to play and how we can craft stories. And coming from a place of film and television, my goal has always been to create cinematic experience. Like that is, I create games that I want to play, and the kind of games I want to play are games that tell stories that are cinematic and exciting and adventurous and engaging in some way. And so my focus really has been in my personal projects to like find play experiences that engage with players in a way that maybe they haven't experienced. And, you know, I reserve the right to like explore outside of that space. I don't want to pigeonhole myself into that too much. But like that has been kind of my focus for the last couple of years, is finding ways of creating experiences rather than just games.
And it really shows in games like Alice is Missing. One of the conversation pieces that I had around the game was, everybody sits down when they play any tabletop RPG or board game, they have their phone. Everybody's checking their phones and their messages.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. And I still can't believe it hasn't been done to just incorporate the phone into the play. Like how did you make that connection and just go, oh, the phone is the centerpiece?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as straightforward as one might think, and I think that the path to game design is a long and winding one, right? Like the focus for me in the beginning was I was listening to a song, which is the first song on the soundtrack for the game, and I had an image, single image, that's actually the image that's on the back of the introduction card now. And I had both of those sitting on my screen, and I was like, I want to make a game out of it, and I don't know how, but like this song and this image, those are a game,
right?
And then I started thinking about how I could play with the space, right? Like I'm always trying to think about like, how do we innovate? How do we press forward? How do we do stuff that's different? And I thought about how I could take away a sense, and I took away speaking. I was like, what if I made an RPG, which is pretty much all about speaking, and I just took that away? What would happen? How would we play? What would we do? And so that sort of collided with my desire, my white whale of crafting a GM-less mystery RPG. Because mysteries in RPGs are hard when you're a GM, at least for me. I love doing mystery games. I love doing mystery campaigns. But like, how many clues do you drop? Where do you drop? How do you drop them? Like that's sort of, right. You know, and finding that balance is really hard. And then when you take away a GM, it becomes a lot of like, we just have to make it up. Like there are some games that are GM-less and are mystery RPGs that you just have to, the ones that I've played, you just have to like decide as a table what the answer is, right? And that doesn't feel as cool to me because we're not discovering it, right? It's like we're making it up. So there's like this, I don't know. I mean, we're always making stuff up, but you know what I mean? Like we're basically going, okay, what makes sense here that would be the culprit? Or what makes sense here is like this thing, instead of being like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is the answer. And so that was my white whale of game design, was like, how do I craft something that is a mystery, that is GM-less, but that has a definitive answer and end without having to make the players decide based on context of the game. And then I decided to throw those all into a pot together and see what came out, which was like, now we have a mystery RPG that we have to have an ending. I want to have a definitive ending for that. I want to create like an, you know, want to create what feels like an actual mystery out of, but I don't want the players to talk. And so I was like, how do we have them communicate? And I don't know how it came. I mean, I wrote Alice is Missing, a silent role-playing game, which was very much inspired by like Life is Strange, right? Like that kind of feel with the game system and the image. And
Right.
And out of that, I was like, what do we do? What do they do in Life is Strange? Or what do they do in these games? Like, in like the movie Searching, where it's about a young girl who goes missing and the whole thing takes place on a computer screen. And it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And I was like, how do they use technology to sort of like move that story along? And then I was like, what happens if we send text? And from that, like the whole thing kind of exploded. And yeah, fell down a rabbit hole there. And I used a lot of inspiration from like LARP, because LARP is very immediate. And if you're playing in a text message space, like you're not really going to be speaking out of character, especially if it's silent. So I had to fall into some LARP areas and go like, okay, what are they doing there? And how do they push the story along? And so I pulled some stuff from Unheroes, which is a LARP that my very first LARP I ever played. And I haven't played, I think that's my only LARP I've ever played, at Big Bad Con, I think it's 2018. I played it, and it had a really cool, like at certain times, certain things happen mechanic, and everybody has a time that's on the back of their like badge with their name on it. And at that time, something happens. And so I took that and sort of like bled that into this game in some way. And yeah, it all just kind of like fell out of the sky in a matter of a week. And that was the first draft of the game.
That's awesome. When you were starting to, you know, pitch it around and move into, you know, some hard play testing, did you meet any kind of opposition or resistance? I mean, you said it yourself, most RPGs, especially in tabletop, they're very vocal. They're very socialized games. And then to say, oh, we're still going to have the social aspect, but it's on your phone.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because from the reactions I had from it when I was like, okay, we're going to play a game, but it's all going to be through text message. There's a lot of level of intrigue that happens there, but there's also a level of like, how is this going to work? And yeah, that's scary. And honestly, I mean, the first time I brought a group in to play it, I knew that I had something that was weird. Right, that was like super weird in the game space, and as a game designer, I'm always looking at like there's plenty of games I can make, but what should I put my focus on that like is commercial enough to be able to succeed, but is cool enough to be able to like push the industry a little bit, right? Like how do I create something that like teeters on that edge? And Icarus was trying to do that by like introducing dice stacking in a very meta sort of, you know, a plot. The way that you create narrative is very meta in that game. And so with Alice, I knew I wanted to keep pushing that, but I didn't know how it was going to go. And so I brought a group of friends over who were some of my closest playtesting like friends, closest game friends that I knew wouldn't judge me if the whole thing fell apart. And I had no idea whether it was going to work. Honestly, I like went in thinking and warning them, like, I have no idea whether this is going to function at all or whether it's going to fall apart. But like, if it does, we'll just stop down and we'll talk about it and we'll playstorm it and we'll figure it out. And it was 60 minutes at that time, not 90. And that 60 minutes was the fastest, most intense 60 minutes I've ever had in any game I've played. It was bonkers because that whole 90-minute game structure that we have now, but squished into 60 minutes. There's every 5 minutes the cards are coming up. And
oh, wow.
We got done and we're just like exhausted and our brains were on fire. And, you know, there were obviously pieces that like I needed to adjust and things that, you know, changes to cards I wanted to make to introduce new cool elements. And we talked about all that stuff. But like after that first play test, we were all like, this is something special. Like there is something in this. And we have to move forward with it. And I always look for that when we're designing something. Happened with Icarus, happened with Kids on Brooms, it happened with this. Like you play a ton of games, you try and figure out which ones you're going to move forward with. I mean, I've designed a bunch of stuff that's never seen the light of day. But like when you have that moment, that thing inside you that's like, This is the one you need to do. Like you have to listen to that voice, because then it was full steam ahead. And I was playtesting pretty much every week, trying to get this thing in a place where I thought it was ready. And I still didn't know if anybody was going to pick it up, if anybody would even give it the time of day. And you know, whether it was like my friends just being nice. I mean, I knew I loved it and I knew it was the kind of game that I wanted to play. And that's all that's important to me at the end of the day. But like, I don't know. I just didn't. I had no idea whether it was going to work or not. And then I took it to Big Bad Con and we played a bunch of playtests and it was buzzing around the con. And I was like, there's something here. Like I have to listen to my intuition here. I have to listen to what everybody is saying, because there's something magical here. So I didn't get too much resistance in that way. Everybody I introduced it to were like, that's weird, but it's interesting. And I want to play it, try it, you know?
And then you guys closed at 140-ish thousand on your Kickstarter for it.
Yeah, and by the time we got to backer kit, because we left the backer kit open on the back end for another like week, I think we hit about 180. So,
oh wow,
yeah. So it was. I can't overstate how much like this project was gonna be my heartbreak game. This was gonna be the game that like I loved so much, and that I was so afraid was never gonna see the light of day. And I mean, still, there's still anxiety in my chest because it hasn't delivered yet to backers. I mean, it's delivered in the digital form, but the physical hasn't delivered yet.
Right.
And this is the game that like took every single ounce of who I am and what I do. Like it drained me more than anything else I've ever made in a good way. Like it took everything I had. And so in the moment, when I was playtesting it before Ivan and Hunters ended up picking it up, I was like, I love this thing. And this is the game I want to keep playing because I love what it does to the table. I love the emotional like interaction I get to have with my friends with it. But my God, there's no publisher that's ever going to pick this thing up. It's so weird. And then I pitched to Ivan and he was like, that sounds really cool. Let's try it. And then they picked it up and it was like, I was like, okay, but like, what it's going to do, you know, it's going to maybe meet its funding goal. And then the first day we blew through funding in like a couple of hours. And then it became real that like, this was something that it wasn't just me that cared about it, right? It wasn't just me that found it intriguing. Like people actually found this thing interesting. And we also had the pandemic that's happening right now that hit, that made like playing via text message a really innovative, timely thing that would just happen to be luck. Like it was all luck.
Right.
Like it wasn't something that we were playing that, you know, it was something that I had made before we had any of this happen. So yeah, really, really fortuitous timing, in that regard as well. And we got really lucky.
I mean, the emotional roller coaster of starting with, you know, just that flash in a pan idea, moving through a week of putting it together to thousands. I'm talking thousands of people backing it, playing it. It's on Twitch now. I've seen multiple live streams.
Yeah.
I've heard, you know, multiple different interactions on podcasts. Like, where are you at mentally knowing that Alice is Missing was not only just adopted, but is now loved and is setting kind of a new capstone for what you can do in the game space?
Terrified, absolutely terrified. In the sense that like I, you know, as creatives, we're always looking to make cool stuff. We're always like looking to put our designs out there and hoping that people like the things that we do. And I say terrified, half jokingly. The reception, people backed it not knowing what it was like, right? I mean, they got an explanation of it, but they had never played it. And for me, the explanation is like, it's the hook, right? But it's not the game. And the game itself is what I was really proud of. The hook was cool. And coming from the film and TV world, like, the hook is what you need to get in the door. The hook is what you need to get somebody to read your script. The script itself actually has to be good. In this case, the game itself has to actually be good, right?
Right.
For anybody to actually make it, want to do it. And so there's this really neat thing where we had thousands of people. I don't even know how many people it was, but thousands of people backing a game, not knowing what it was like. And then there's the pressure of like, I think this thing is good. I believe in this thing. But are those, you know, I think it was 5,000. I keep wanting to say five, and I'm not sure if that's right. It might be more like four.
5,600 on...
5,600. Okay, good. I wasn't lying. My brain wasn't lying to me. Are all of those people going to be disappointed when they get it? Is it not going to be what they thought, what they wished that it would be? Like, that's it forever. Like, we have this hook that's really interesting, but, like, are people going to like it? And we played it on Twitch for the first time for Gen Con, and that was, like, the premiere of the game. For most people, I mean, I had played it, you know, probably upwards of like 70 or 80 times by then. So I was confident that it would run, and I was confident in the game. I was confident it'd be a good game. But like to give people their first preview of it was terrifying. And then every game I see people playing on Twitter or anything, always like I'm terrified that they're not going to have a good time with it. Because it's not like a normal RPG where if it takes a GM to run it and like, you know, the mechanics are there, and then it's sort of up to the GM to like make the game in some way engaging. And if it doesn't go well, like, well, it's not really on me because it's not, it's up to them to sort of figure out what their story is. And there's so many other factors. This thing is like on my shoulders. That was the scariest part. Like if they didn't have a good time, either I didn't explain the directions clearly enough, or the game is not good. Like those are the two options you have when those things happen. And or the player, you know, it does take a level of creativity. So it's like there definitely is an element of like player interaction there. But I felt a lot more pressure in this than I did in other games to get it right. So to see that come through, see people playing it and enjoying it, and you know, I'm seeing tweets come in of like people being like, I've never had an experience like this playing games. It just like it makes me flabbergasted and I can't. It's overwhelming in that regard. Like I don't want to let people down, and so that's always my fear.
I gotcha. So one of the other topics that we've kind of touched on throughout Alice is the style of GM-less games.
Yeah.
So Kids on Bikes, you know, kind of leans off of the GM. Alice leans off of the GM, and then you also worked on Perilous with Jordan.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. I'm in the process of working on that right now.
We chatted with Jordan as well. So what?
Oh, cool.
What led you to the notion of stepping away from the GM? Because for decades now, the GM is this kind of coveted role at a table. And at least in some of the conversations I've had, they're like, wait, there's nobody leading.
Yeah. So
like, how did you get there?
Again, I think it comes from my background as a writer, right? And as somebody who likes to be in a writer's room, there's somebody who's facilitating the writer's room, but everybody's a writer. And that's how I approach even my GM'd games. Even games that I GM, I turn to the players and go, describe this thing for me. Or, you know, what about this thing is so dangerous? I just throw it to them because we're all telling a story together. And the more they have, honestly, like, let's take that, like, what about this is dangerous with good players, with players that you trust and players that you know are going to work towards making a good story. You throw that to them and they give you something more dangerous than you ever would have introduced. Right. And I watched this interaction happen as I was playing these GM games. And I love giving my players power in that regard, because not only does it take weight off of me, which allows me to focus on making the things that are happening the best they can be, or the things that I am deciding like the best they can be, because I'm going, okay, you tell me this. Oh, and let me add to this. Or somebody else goes, oh yeah, what else? What if this happens too, or whatever? And like, we sort of build that together. But they're invested. I'm not telling them, I'm not giving them a gnome runs up to you asking you for help with this task that you know nothing about to face off against this frost giant, and you're going up to steal this treasure that you maybe has some monetary value. It's fine if you just want to like roll some dice and do the thing, and that's the style of play. But for me, I want my players to like care. I want the games I'm playing to feel like a movie. And in every movie, there's a reason for them to be doing this stuff. And even if your characters don't necessarily have that reason, which I think it's honestly, it's best if your characters do have some sort of emotional buy-in. If your players have buy-in, that replicates that experience. And so I watched that happening in my GM'd game that I was running. It's like, we gotta just bring this to like you just make a game that's like this, right? And so I played a bunch of GM-less games and saw that those were things that existed. I mean, we were looking at Fiasco and The Quiet Year and these kinds of games that turned the industry, or the genre, I should say, on its head. The medium, that's the right one. The medium on its head. And so I really loved getting my friends in the same room around a table, whether virtual or otherwise, and watching them be creative. That's the most fun I have in playing games. And so I wanted to make games that allowed my friends to do that, but allowed me to like facilitate that for them, right? For me to give them the opportunity to bring that creativity to the table. And a lot of my friends are, because I work in the film industry, a lot of my friends are writers. A lot of my friends are, you know, are artists, are actors, are filmmakers. And so they have that mindset already. So why not give them the power to like do that, you know, to do what they're good at? So yeah, that's kind of the way that I approached it. And that's why I tend to gravitate towards those. And look, I play a lot of GM'd games. I don't want to give the wrong impression. Like, most of my gaming is GM'd gaming, except for the stuff that I play test. But when I make a game that's on my own, I have very specific things that I'm looking for. And even if it was GM'd, it would still probably be very collaborative, stuff that I work on. You know, obviously, like collaborating with somebody like Jordan, or collaborating with somebody like, you know, Doug and John, like those are opportunities for me to work on different aspects of games. Like with Doug and John, I had built Kids on Brooms and I wanted to make Kids on Brooms because I loved that kind of world. And I didn't see a game that filled that niche for me. Obviously, Harry Potter has also become sort of contentious in the past couple of months. And so it was, or past couple of years. So that was an opportunity for us to create the world, the wizarding world that we want to play, right? It gives you the opportunity to like live out this fantasy. So with Jordan, it was like, I wanted the challenge of taking a game that was traditionally GM and going, how do I make this with all the same mechanics or most of the same mechanics? How do I make that GM? So those are sort of challenges and like opportunities for me. But yeah, the coming into a GM-less design space for me is always about creating the opportunity for my players to show me the cool stuff that's in their brain. That's what I care about.
Awesome. Do you think it's going to be a design principle that you're going to continue to carry forward or just when the opportunity arises?
Frankly, I have no idea. I take a game at a time. I have a bunch of games that are GM'd that I've been working on. I have a bunch of games that are GM-less that I've been working on. We'll see what goes forward. But I just sort of do whatever makes me excited at the table.
Now, another concept that we keep coming back to is of collaboration. You've worked with some of the big names, the bright stars, the rising stars in the industry. How do you go about networking specifically? It's a very small industry when you get to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, it can feel vast and insurmountable.
Sure, from the offset. Well, I even sort of told the story about how I bombarded him in an airport. And so I won't rehash that story. If you want to go listen to that. And it's funny because like, from my perspective, I was coming from a Gen Con where I went to sell a game, a different game than the one I pitched him, a card game, board game, and was completely unsuccessful. Paid a ton of money to come out there, networked with a bunch of companies that did board games and card games, got a couple of bites, nothing ever came out of it. Nothing came out of it during the con. And I had like, you know, some like, we'll circle back with you and stuff, but I felt like I had failed completely. And so I was sitting in the airport and I was like totally downtrodden about the experience I had had. I felt like I had just wasted money and that I had failed going out to do the thing I wanted to do. And then I saw Ivan there, and Ivan and I knew each other. Like you said, we knew each other through mutual friends. So like, I wanted to go and introduce myself because we never actually met, and we were talking. And then I pitched him a thing that I was working on, and we ended up taking it to Chris, his partner. And I sort of explained it, and they were like, you know, I don't really want to do a bathtub kind of game, which was totally fair. And now is not a system I'd ever make. Which is interesting. It was definitely a design choice based on me trying to get my friends to play games with me and being like, okay, you can learn one system and be able to play Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings. We can come in every week and like play those together. And it just wasn't the right design choice. It wasn't focused. You see all of these sort of like flaws and the stuff that you make if you back up from it. But our conversation led us into an interesting space. And so what I learned from that was like, I could tell Ivan was tired. I didn't want to like bombard him too much. But also, I didn't even realize that he ran a publishing company when I ran into him in the airport. I had no idea that he had published Kids on Bikes. I knew nothing of that. I just knew that he was like somebody who worked in the space and we were both going to the same place. And so I talked with him and slowly discovered out of the conversation that he ran the company that made Kids on Bikes. So yeah, that was a big lucky break for us. But also, having the game design knowledge, like going in with it with an idea and being able to pivot when that idea is not something that they want. That's all something that comes out of like playing and making a lot of games. And so that was the first push in. But from there, after Icarus got picked up and we had the ball rolling on that, by that point I knew that they had done Kids on Bikes. And so I was like, Ivan, I have a hack that I've been playing with my friends that I've been playtesting a bunch that I'd love to pitch you. It's called Kids on Brooms, and like it's sort of like a Harry Potter kind of art. And he was like, they're making Kids on Brooms right now. And I was like, okay, cool, gonna pack it up, go home. Enough of this. Like, throw away all the work I've done for the past 3 months, and yeah, sayonara. And he was like, well, I can put you in touch with them, and like you can see if they want to collaborate. So I put together a whole like big pitch deck, a pitch package with all the ideas I had and things like mechanics I had changed and all the things that I had done to the game to sort of show them why I would be valuable in some way, hoping that there would be some sort of, I mean, I expected them to be like, this is really cool, but we're already working on the game and we already have it set, but like, we'd love to have you as a playtester or something. And they reached out and were like, there's some really cool stuff here that you did that we didn't think of. There's some places here that you talked about wanting to do stuff that we have ideas on. Do you want to come on? And that was the start of our friendship. And honestly, like And I say that meaningfully, like that was the start of our friendship. We became friends. You know, we were game designers, and it's hard. I mean, for them, like bringing on somebody, they have no idea who I am. They have no idea what, you know, they know that I published Icarus, but like they haven't played it because it hasn't come out yet. So like for them to sort of take me on in that way, we had a voice or a video chat before because they're not in the same place as I am. We just like hit it off and we were bouncing ideas around and it became very apparent that like we were good collaborators. And so they brought me on to do that. And that sort of, you know, left me into like, okay, I'm no longer just working on this. It's still an indie project, but like, I'm no longer just working on Icarus, which is this tiny indie project that I'm making myself, but I'm working with somebody like Doug and John, who have a track record of making stuff that's really cool and, you know, and unique and does well. And yeah, that sort of just springboarded me into working on other projects.
That's awesome. While you are, you're designing, making your game, and you're going through all the different processes, it's not just like sitting down in a computer and writing. It's a lot of like looking for references, looking for material,
yeah,
referencing game.
For sure.
And you also have a full-time job on top of that.
Yeah.
I never feel like the two are competing.
For sure. I mean, I think there's a healthy level of cross-pollination there. I'll be making a game, I'll be working on a game and suddenly realize something for work that I could take from that. In fact, one of the things I just shot was a very much a game. Like I had to use my game. I did another trivia show with Cash App for 100 Thieves, the company I work at. And I've been writing all of those shows. And that's very much like a game. It's a game. It's a trivia game, but it's a game. And so like making that thing, we just did our first five live shows this past week. And so like there was very much game design being bled into that. So I'm lucky in that I have the opportunity to do a lot of things that sort of cross-pollinate. But yeah, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Right.
I think, you know, the same way that like when you're a screenwriter, you don't just read scripts. You need to read scripts, but you don't just read scripts. You have to go out and like do stuff. Like you have to read books and you have to like go to foreign countries and you have to like drive a race car and like do these kinds of things that like give you inspiration for the thing that you're going to be writing about. I think of the same way game design falls in that same category, right? Like I don't like Alice is Missing became a thing because I played Life is Strange and watched Searching because I slack with all of my people from work and sometimes communication, you know, there I think I'm saying something that is clear and they're like, wait, I don't understand what you're saying. And, you know, can you clarify or whatever? Not a bad way, but just in like, you know, like that's how conversation between in text when we're spread out throughout the country, like some of us are, that's a way that we communicate even through email, right? It's not the same as text, but it's similar. And so looking at those exchanges, having those kinds of conversations, like all of that is super important to game design. And I think we have to take those life experiences and apply them here in order for us to innovate. You know, otherwise we're looking at the same game being made over and over and over, which
right.
It is fine. Look, if you want to take mechanics and change them to be the way you want them at your table, by all means, we should be doing that. We should be innovating in that way. But if we want to create new experiences, if we want to stretch the medium, if we want to push RPGs to be more than just D&D, we gotta push people into new spaces in some way. And so that comes from allowing that cross-pollination to happen, embracing it when it does happen, writing down your ideas and continuing to focus on the thing you're working on. But I think it's healthy and I think it's good.
Nice. I like that take. So you have one foot in games, and then the other foot you're with 100 Thieves,
yeah,
live streaming and very in tune with the video game scene.
Yeah.
Have you ever considered going and writing a video game, a Life is Strange style kind of a game?
I think that there's the opportunity for sure to like explore that kind of space. The video game space takes so much to be able to like make it happen. I fear that I would fall into the same kind of problem I run into in movies and TV, where you're having to have these massive budgets to be able right. to like do things. And what I love about tabletop games, the thing that makes me excited about sitting down with my friends to play an RPG is that I get to is that it's us being creative. It's us imagining things in our head and being able to like bring that to life through the words that we're saying or the communication we're having. And I think Alice rides the closest line for me to a video game. And I think in some ways, it especially when the app comes out for it, it could be considered a video game, right? It's happening on a screen.
Yeah, no, it's fair.
Especially because with the app, there's going to be a premium version that you can buy. And if you do that, you get the prompt sent to you. You don't have to use cards on the table. So everything is being done by the prompt on the app. And so you're no longer even using any physical elements. Suddenly we are playing a video game, right? But the difference for me is that that video game is not driven by a game engine or by a set of writers that are writing out what's happening. And they're giving you, you know, this, they're not the ones that are giving you, I don't know how to capture that, this in words, but you know what I mean? Like they aren't giving you the world in which you're playing in a sense, like,
right.
They give you the prompts, like Alice gives you the prompts and you make everything up. And so that kind of video game is interesting. And I don't know what else is in that space. The only thing I can think of is there's a game on Steam. What is it called? It's like where you're writing messages to each other.
Kind words.
Kind word. That's what it is. That's the closest thing I found to an Alice is Missing kind of video game. And I'm interested in that kind of space where, like, how do we create game experiences that engage players in a way that the tabletop space does? You know, in a multiplayer, like a multiplayer game where everybody is making stuff up and that's forming the game mm-hmm. is fascinating to me. You know, and Alice already kind of does that. So I don't want to explore that space too much. But I think if I were to go into a game design space, that's probably what I would favor.
I gotcha. Yeah, it's a tabletop is almost a spiritual kind of a journey. Everybody's just so invested in, you know, beginning to end. You really see it in the Critical Role community. Everyone with any kind of connection to it, yeah. they've been changed as, you know, as a player, as a DM. Like you can really see it. And I think it's that creative drive, that creative engine, rather than just sitting on a little train track, you know, do you want to go left or do you want to go right?
Like right, right, right.
Video games. Okay. While you're picking away at your total game making process, where do you personally like to go for inspiration? Do you head on down to your local game store and pick out just a couple random games? Do you dive onto Steam? Like where do you generally look?
So I'm a really visual person. So most of my game design is either like kinesthetic or is visual. So I will either play with components and figure out something tactical that is, sorry, not tactical, tactile, there's the word. I will find something that like feels good in my hands and feels cool at the table. That's how Icarus came to be. Or with Alice, I just went and found some images. Like I just literally found like a mood board and was like, okay, this image in particular, but like I pulled a couple of things that sort of gave me inspiration. All of these are a game and I don't know what it is yet, but I feel it. And then obviously there's like the music, and Alice is the only thing that I've done that was very music based. But I think that came from, that was like the Life is Strange inspiration, right? Was like, Life is Strange is so, its soundtrack is so good that I just had that on in the background, and that really inspired like that game. So, but I tend to go to places like ArtStation and I'll just look at what's trending. And just scroll down the page. And a lot of it's fantasy and sci-fi and those kinds of things. And so if you're looking in that space, that's a good place to go. If you're not looking in that space, probably not a good place to go. But also what I'll look for in those images are like, I look for the specifics in those images. If there's a sci-fi image, right, I'm not looking at the fact that like I'm using this as inspiration for sci-fi. I'm looking at the fact that like, okay, this is a crashed spaceship and there's a family who's coming, you know, who's running from the spaceship. And they're carrying bundles of wheat in their arms. What has happened here, right? Are we telling the story? Could we create a game that's the story of a family who is taking in somebody who's crashed from another planet? And they have a totally different culture and they come from a totally different space. And one player is playing that person who's created their own sort of, you know, they have their own questionnaire of things that they've decided about what their character is. And this family, who are all the other players, are playing people that, you know, have a very decidedly different point of view on the stuff that's happening. Maybe there's a war that's happening, right? Suddenly we get this expansion. We're like, okay, this is somebody who's on the other side of the war, who's crash landed here, and instead of being killed, has been taken in by this family. And they're on two separate sides of this thing. How does this conversation go between them? And it's a 30-minute game where we explore like the conversation between them and how reconciliation happens. And, you know, at the end, they turn them over. There's a game, right? From that image, it's not just sci-fi. It's like,
right,
how do I pick out those specific points in an image and craft a narrative around? And yeah, I mean, you can see like just going through all of those, just going through that one setting. I'm not even looking at an image. I'm just making it up in my head. But like looking at that kind of thing, you can just draw as long as the image is telling a story, which is what a really good artist does, right? They look at like,
right,
how an image tells a story. As long as it's doing that, I can make a game from it. And so I'll find the things that speak to me and hone in on those aspects and just find something cool and explore it. See if it works. And if it does, then great. And if it doesn't, you just file it away and go to the next image.
So if you had to pick one aspect of game design to just kind of pin on a board as your favorite aspect, what would you honestly say it is?
It's tough because it depends on what kind of game you're playing. But I think it goes back to something I've talked about before, but I think the word collaborative is super key for me. Even if I'm playing a GM'd game, in order for me to want to play it as a player, in order for me to want to play it as a GM, I have to be able to engage with my player's creativity. And so that would be the word that I would put in the center and then let things...
The word map fall around it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that, you know, there's GMless and there's GM'd out of collaborative, right? There's like...
Right, right.
Yeah, like you can expand out of that, but I think that's my starting.
I gotcha. And then on the opposite side of the same coin, what would you say is the most challenging or difficult aspect of game design for yourself?
It's a tough question. I think the things that make me more wary in game design are incredibly crunchy, dense systems. I think that there is certainly value in them. I think that people that love to play those kinds of games, like, more power to you.
Right.
I don't want to read a 400-page book on how to run this game. I just don't.
Right.
I just don't. I have no interest in it. It doesn't... I don't want to make my players read it. Like, I just don't. It doesn't speak. And some people love getting into that crunch. They love getting deep into, like, or even into the lore, right? Like a right. book that has like 200 pages of crunch of mechanics and 200 pages of lore. I have very little interest in reading about a world that somebody has sat down and created all on their own, and they have like every aspect of this society planned out, down to like what their religious, you know, beliefs are and down to what foods they eat. Really cool. Some people love that stuff. More power to you. Go and do your thing. I would much rather look at my players and go, what's the architecture here like?
Right, right.
Right? Why is this architecture not like any place you've ever been before? But then listen to what they say, and then take the things that they say, and then think about how I can expand on those and introduce characters and aspects of the world that reflect that. They're like, this whole place is made of coral, right? Cool. There's this whole coral city. It's like built out of the ocean, right? It's like in this shallow space. Awesome. My brain goes, who lives there? Mermaids, fish people, anybody that sort of like has a, maybe like, a, you know, sea slug kind of like amorphous kind of thing. Like, we have all these things. Okay, we have all of that stored away. And then what are the issues they have there? Maybe the coral is dying. Maybe there's some sort of disease. You have all these things. And so now suddenly, instead of having a planned adventure where like you have all of that laid out for you already, I've just taken what they've given and gone, here are a bunch of options you have. Or here are, you know, here's the options I'm giving you. I haven't even given them all those options. You know, you present them one of them. But like, still, the flow of the game, the flow of the story is now being directly impacted by the choices they made.
Right, right.
And now they care about Barnabas the Barnacle, right? Because they made up the coral thing, and they know that Barnabas came out of the thing that they made. And so, yeah, so that's sort of the space that I love to live in. And, you know, and I find that crunch and lots of lore tends to work against that aspect.
Right. It's the sandbox versus the railroad kind of a concept at large scope.
Right. 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 Because then suddenly you're like, you know, you approach the city and somebody's like, oh, what if it's like a city made of coral? And you're like, but I've planned this whole city out to be like a something totally different, and I have all of this like laid out in my piece of paper, deviating from that now becomes really hard because you've already done that work, or you've already read the stuff and you've memorized it and you've done all this, and you have to throw all that out, and then it becomes, then it feels bad, you know? So anyway, that's, I avoid that kind of stuff just as a designer and as a, and as a, I love what Plays in the Dark does for its like location and gangs and those kinds of things. Like it gives me the perfect amount of inspiration to be able to go, here's kind of what this looks like, but like you make up the rest. I think that's really brilliant. But yeah, I try and avoid any sort of heavy, heavy crunch or heavy lore. And like, also I try and make games that are accessible to people that are new to the industry. The people I tend to have in my game groups, well, now they're experienced players because we've been playing together for so long, but like I tend to pull people in that haven't played games before because they're all writers and producers and actors and stuff. And so they don't want to be doing, they don't want to be opening up a spreadsheet and
diving in. Yeah.
Doing all their calculations for their dice roll and hit, you know, hit placement and those kinds of things on it. Like they want to just roll some dice and figure out what happens next. So I tend to grab.
Nice. And then the last question that I really have, if you had to distill one piece of advice for anybody looking to get into game design, tabletop RPG design, what would you give them?
It's tough because I think you have to listen to your gut. And what I mean by that is that, I'm gonna break your rule. I'm gonna give them two things. Listen to your gut about what you want to play, what makes you excited, what gets you feeling those like butterflies, right? If you're playing your game and you're not, and this is not the kind of game that you want to be playing, probably don't make it.
Right.
You have to play test so much when you make a game. At least I do, and I recommend others do, that you have to love what you're making. You have to care about it. If you don't love it, if you don't feel deeply for it, if you aren't being evangelical about the game that you're playing, nobody else is going to want to play it.
Right.
You have to be the one, you have to be the driving force. You have to be excited so that other people are excited. And you don't want to fake that. You want to be genuinely excited about the thing you're making. You have to find that buzz, that thing that makes you come back to it at 3 a.m. right after you've had a long day of work already and you're laying down and your brain is still racing about the, like, find the game that keeps you up, find the game that drives. But the other thing I will say is, and this is the other piece of advice, is don't try to do what other people are doing just because other people are doing, right? Like, don't make a game that's, at least this is advice I follow, and you know, making a PBTA game, I love PBTA. I play lots of PBTA games. I'm making PBTA games right now, but I'm making them because the theme is something that I love, and I feel like PBTA matches the kind of play that I want. You need to find a hook. You need to have something in your game that gives it distinction from all the other games that are out there. Because if you just make another fantasy game, yeah, you might love that you have this sort of dueling mechanic that you've put into it. But that's not, sorry, it's not good enough. Like,
right.
Tack that onto a game that already exists. Make a like a module or some sort of like pamphlet or something that can go along with a game that already exists to add that kind of piece in. But like, unless your game is about dueling, right? Unless you're making a dueling game, in which case, great, lean into that. But make it about that. You got to find the thing. If you want your game to get published, if you want to reach a wide audience, if you want to get a publisher, somebody other than you or your friend, like, you got to find that hook. And that takes really taking a hard look in the mirror and going, what am I making here? And is it different enough from what other people are making? And I those are two completely maybe conflicting notions that I've given, but I think the combination of those two things has led me to what I'm doing now. It is my North Star when I'm making a game, right? I'm looking at like, how can I do something that's totally different that pushes the industry in some way, and what makes me excited about that. So yeah, that's kind of I think my guiding star that I give other people.
No, I love it. I love it. Well, that's awesome. And, you know, Spencer, thank you so much again for coming on and really just peeling back all of the layers of your game design.
Yeah.
You know, I greatly appreciate it. I love following your journey and the different games that you've been creating.
Thank you.
So So for everybody, every one of our listeners, where can we find you on social media?
Yeah.
Your games?
So you can find me at Spencer Stark on Twitter. That's SpencerStarke. You can find most of the games that I make at Hunters Entertainment or Renegade Studios. Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on. It's such a pleasure to chat with you about my favorite thing in the whole world. So I appreciate it.
And I'll make sure to link those actual plays in the show notes so everybody can just, you know, guide out to that as well.
Yeah.
And then, you know what, just one more before we go. Is there anything on the immediate horizon that we should be keeping an eye out for you're doing?
Yeah. So The House Doesn't Always Win is a game by my friend named Wheels. He's a producer, video producer over at Dicebreaker. He launched the Kickstarter yesterday that it launched. It's already funded. It's doing really great. I'm writing a module for that. And it is one of my favorite games I've played in the last year. It is so, so good. It's about resistance, like forming a resistance. So it's like you could play, you know, a cyberpunk game in it, but you could also play like the rebels in Star Wars with it. Like it's all about being the underdogs, fighting back against some sort of like big oppressive force. And you know, so the module I'm writing for it is a pirate module. So basically you're like swashbucklers, like underdog swashbucklers running from the Red King and trying to stay alive on the high seas. And it uses a deck of cards as its main mechanic, and it's just so good. Like Wheels pulled me into a playtest of it or into a game of it a couple months ago, and you know, I had never played anything Wheels had made. He interviewed Icarus for us on Dicebreaker, and him and I chatted about that, and I played it and was like, dude, this is so good. Like, like I'm like, I anyway, it is worth backing 100%. It's already funded, so, but my stretch goal is still waiting to be hit there. I mean, it's only been one day, so, you know, this we still have some time, but yeah, going back that so I get to write a really cool motto for a really, really great game.
Awesome. And, you know, Spencer, thank you. Thank you so much again.
Of course.
And have a lovely rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Bardic Babble. Bardic Babble is a part of the Bard Podcast Network's family of shows. You can find Bardic Babble and all of our other shows at thebardpodcast.com. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe for updates on new episodes. We can't wait to share the next story with you.